Welcome to Building a Better Brain, sponsored by EEGChicago.com, with your host, Dr. Jim Kowal, on Chicago's Christian Talk Radio, AM 1160. The professionals at EEG Chicago are highly qualified providers of neurofeedback throughout the Chicagoland area. To learn more about this weekly program, Building a Better Brain, or to find a provider in your area, visit EEGChicago.com. That's EEGChicago.com. And now your host, Dr. Jim Kowal.
Through the airwaves over the beautiful Windy City. Good morning, Chicago, and welcome to Building a Better Brain. As we continue our series that provides you information on how you can improve your brain and overcome a number of difficulties and blocks that keeps you from performing your very best, we will be exploring questions such as, what does your genes have to do with the way your brain functions? And to answer that question today, I'm very pleased to have a special guest, Jay Gunkelman, who is one of the top leaders in the field of EEG and QEEG. I've been to many of Jay's workshops and have not found anyone that knows more about this field and has experience in using QEEGs as Jay does. But first of all, let me tell you a little more about Jay. Mr. Jay Gunkelman is a QEEG diplomat and is a highly respected person in the field of neurofeedback. He has processed over a half of a million EEGs since 1972. He is the past president of the International Society for Neurofeedback and Research and for the Biofeedback Society of California, as well as a board member of the Association for Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. He has conducted, published, and participated in hundreds of research papers, articles, and books, and conducts meetings both nationally and internationally. He is the co-founder and the chief science officer for Brain Science International and is a popular lecturer worldwide. So I am very pleased to welcome Jay to the program. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Well, good morning. Recovering from too much travel, but enjoying the day.
Yes, yes. I understand you were out on the East Coast conducting a program out there.
Yeah, and I'm back in the San Francisco Bay Area again, enjoying the nice weather out here.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. One of the things we wanted to talk about is some of the work that you have done, which has been very exciting, and that is correlating brain activity to your genetic makeup. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. The paper we published in 2005 looked retrospectively at 35 years of experience with EEG, QEG, and I simply listed the common patterns that we identify in failures of brain function. And rather than worry about the diagnostic DSM name for the categories, I simply looked at the patterns. And with a limited list of 11 common failure modes, we predict almost all the variants within the EEG. So we basically, in looking at this list of 11 patterns, we identified that two of them had known genetic correlates, and the concept of endophenotype, expression of the genes as an intermediate step between genetics and behavior, you can end up seeing the epigenetics and endophenotypes. And these are genetically linked characteristics that end up predicting therapy and outcomes with medication and neurofeedback, but they're not identical to the DSM. Quite a few people look at a disorder like obsessive compulsive disorder, which there's only one kind in the DSM, and we find physiologically that there are actually three kinds of OCD, and these subcategories that we identified physiologically end up predicting the therapeutic response to medication. And as such, these aren't academic subdivisions of a behavioral category. They're meaningful clinical differentiation. And interestingly, the entire diagnostic manual, which is just about to be released in the DSM-5 at the APA conference out here in California, in San Francisco, I guess about another week and a half before it'll be released, but they've already said that it's not valid. The director of NIMH, Dr. Insel, basically asked for researchers to propose research going towards a new classification system that's based on biological markers and endophenotypes and not the behavioral categories of the DSM-5. So although it's being released in a week and a half, they've already declared it invalid. And as such, we're looking at a classification system that doesn't give you a name for your disorder. It tells you how to treat it. Mm. And that's much more meaningful. Ultimately, you know, name calling is not what medicine is all about. It's treatment. Mm-hmm. And in neurofeedback and in medication prediction, the model that we looked at retrospectively and published in 2005 has now been tested prospectively going forward. If you look in the rearview mirror and you think you see how things work, you still need to look out the front window of the car to drive. So you can't use a retrospective study without testing it going forward. You know,
that's right.
Produce theories based on retrospective data, but you really need to test it, you know, going forward, not in reverse. So we've actually done a fair amount of that, and it's being tested by other parties as well. And one of the approaches that we did was to look at medication prediction in ADD-ADHD, and we had 49 ADD-ADHD kids and 49 match controls pulled from the Australian database. This study was done in the Netherlands, in Nijmegen, with Dr. Martijn Aarons. And he invited me over for a lecture, and I arrive a day or so early, and we simply look at all these EEGs together. Independent of each other, he had already classified the EEGs himself prior to my arrival. And the inter-rater reliability was better than 90%. It's a statistic called Cohen's lambda, and better than 0.9 is considered extremely good. One of the criticisms of visual analysis of the EEG is that the inter-rater reliability is very low for diagnostic specificity. And the phenotype patterns aren't the same as trying to look at the EEG diagnostically, because we're not trying to classify something as normal or abnormal. We're simply looking at whether a pattern is present or not. So the inter-rater reliability was much higher than traditional neurological interpretation of the EEG. And given that high reliability, we can then look at the validity of the interpretations. And essentially, the original retrospective paper suggested that one of the 11 patterns would be a stimulant-responsive pattern. And this is a pattern where you have frontal rhythmic slow activity that's due to dopamine deficiency in the striatum, the deep nuclei that are in the brain that are associated with the ADD-ADHD disturbance. And sure enough, the pattern that we had identified previously retrospectively as a stimulant-responsive pattern was the only group to have a significant response to the stimulant medications that were provided. The ability to predict therapy, obviously, is much more important than behavioral classification and naming the disorder. So the ability to predict medication was something that we had hoped to validate. And in addition to the ADD study, later I went back to Nijmegen in the Netherlands and did another lecture with Martijn. And this time when I showed up, he had 126 depressive patients and 126 matched controls. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at predicting the response to SSRIs in depression. That's currently being published, but the quick summary of it was that we, in fact, had a reasonable ability to predict some patterns that would not respond to antidepressants, and we had at the same time done some genetic swab, you know, just inside the mouth collection of the lining of the side of the mouth with a little Q-tip, basically. And in the analysis of that genetic data, we could actually see some correlation between the COMT gene and the EEG data. The genetic analysis is typically not able, you don't see the correlations typically. You end up having to have a supercomputer to crunch the data and find the correlations. But this is one that was visibly able to be identified in the data set with simply a quick review of the data. The company Johnson & Johnson found 100 of the depressive patients that were in the study and brought them in and did a blood draw on them. And they've done full genome workup on 100 individuals that we had previously clustered with the endophenotype model. And as such, they're now, with the supercomputers, finding correlations between genetics and EEG that are present in the data set. They were actually quite surprised at how powerful the EEG was at clustering to predict genetic similarity. Mm-hmm. It's not that surprising, actually, if you have a lot of experience with EEG and you've seen monozygotic twin data. It's pretty easy to match up twins.
Right. Well, I just want to interrupt you for a moment because this is fascinating. And after our break, I want to go into this even deeper and talk about what you have found and also how it applies to addictions. So we will be right back with Mr. Jay Gunkelman.
Did you know you can safely make changes in your brainwave patterns through neurofeedback, which can significantly improve conditions such as ADHD, minor traumatic brain injury, depression, anxiety, autism, and a host of other problems? The dedicated professionals at EEG Chicago are highly qualified providers who can help improve your life or the quality of life of your loved one. Visit the EEG Chicago website today at eegchicago.com. You'll learn new, exciting information on how neurofeedback trains the brain to function with greater control and stability. By learning to adjust the brainwave activity, you can improve your life through this safe and drug-free approach. Visit the website for locations near you and to contact an EEG Chicago professional. Tell them you are an AM 1160 listener. Ask for a first-time consultation. Visit eegchicago.com and learn how to build a better brain. Have you ever wondered about the magic of the brain's functioning? Did you know you can learn to adjust your brainwave activity with neurofeedback? Neurofeedback safely improves conditions such as ADHD, minor traumatic brain injury, autism spectrum disorders, anxiety, depression, as well as many other disorders. The team of specialists at EEG Chicago are highly qualified providers of neurofeedback. Visit their website for a provider in your area and learn how to build a better brain today. Go to eegchicago.com. The highly qualified EEG providers are dedicated to helping improve your life and the quality of lives of your loved ones through this drug-free and safe approach. Visit their website today at eegchicago.com. That's eegchicago.com. Building a better brain can be a reality in your life. Count on the professionals at EEG Chicago to create a treatment plan just for you. Visit eegchicago.com today.
Welcome back to Building a Better Brain. I am talking with Mr. Jay Gunkelman, an EEG researcher and a chief science officer at Brain Science International. And we were talking about Jay's work and the role of genes and how it plays into the brain's activity, and extending that even a little further now, talking about how that relates to addictions. Can you tell us what you found in that area, Jay?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. Well, first of all, the field of neurofeedback actually has an existent efficacy literature in the area of addiction. And they've shown, using the guidelines for evaluating clinical efficacy using psychophysiological interventions approved by the field, they've actually found that the Peniston and Scott protocols, which are basically oriented towards alpha-theta training, are probably efficacious given the quality of the research to support them. So the field already has some obvious direct application to addiction, and the quality of the research still needs to be improved, but this is probably efficacious given the research. Well, in applying neurofeedback in the addiction population, we decided to try to use the phenotype model to predict the neurofeedback protocol and not just rely on the, quote, standard protocol of alpha-theta training. In looking at the EEG, well, the people would come to the train to the addiction program, and we would listen to their story with full empathy. But then we would set the story aside and look at their EEG to tell us what protocol, how to train the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Using this approach, the phenotype-driven approach, 2/3 of the addicted population ended up getting an alpha-theta training because they had central nervous system over arousal. And 1/3 of the addicted population had a totally different drive mechanism related more to obsessive compulsive drive than over arousal. So they got totally different training protocols than the standard protocol would necessarily predict. In the over arousal group, we found low voltage fast EEG was very common. And the low-voltage fast EEG is classically observed in addiction, in fact, most classically to alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
The low-voltage fast EEG is seen in families with alcoholism in the family, and it's associated with gene number 4, which controls GABA-A receptors, and these individuals are functionally over-aroused, and they need the alpha-theta training to train them hypoperfusion correlates of alpha-theta to get rid of the hyperperfusion correlates of their EEG pattern. And the training works really quite nicely on them. In fact, in 1974, I had written an NIH grant for alpha training in the low-voltage fast alcoholics that we saw at a state hospital addiction program. So this approach actually dates back a long ways. But the other two EEG patterns, other than the low-voltage fast type associated with addiction, are fast alpha, where the alpha peak is up at 11 hertz or more, and beta spindles, which are a form of cortical overarousal. The cingulate-related findings basically were localized to the anterior cingulate, which can be identified using low-resolution electromagnetic tomography technology. We essentially trained them to normalize their brain activity, and after 1 year follow-up, we had 30 people that had gone through this program, and we had full sobriety still at 1 year follow-up. We also did pre- and then now at 1 year follow-up, post-Woodcock-Johnson 3 neurocognitive testing, and although they were a normal adult IQ of 99 to start with, they went to 120, which is a 21-point IQ jump
in
a group of 30 individuals. We had an average of a 20-point jump in measures such as thinking ability, which measures the ability to use short-term memory information that can't be automatically processed. And again, from 103, which is a normal standard score for an adult, to a 122, a superior adult. Cognitive efficiency, which looks at information held in working memory and visual perceptual speed, they went from a 94.7 to 118. Again, on the average, a 20-point jump in standard scores.
Mm-hmm.
None of the neurocognitive measures got worse. All of them got better. The best one for increase actually started a little bit decreased, and that's delayed recall, remembering something after a 30-minute delay. Their pre-score was only 65, and they ended at 103, a normal adult.
Mm-hmm.
So Interestingly, when you make the brain work better, it works better.
Yes, it is.
And the neurocognitive score improvement was not really expected. This was a surprise, a pleasant surprise, but a surprise nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common to have what people consider a dry drunk after a treatment program. Although they're abstaining and they're clean and sober, they're not really quite right yet, and the dry drunk phenomenon was essentially avoided here by optimizing their brain function. These people were peak performers when they came out. If you looked only at the neurocognitive improvement, you'd think we were doing peak performance training,
right.
But in fact, these were people coming in for treatment of addiction. Now, we're not differentiating in our treatment model between peak performance and symptom-driven, you know, try to fix a problem type training. Both of them have the same approach.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, performance is optimized as a, quote, side effect. And thank goodness it's this kind of a side effect. I mean, usually think of a side effect as something negative. But here, the side effect of optimizing brain function is that the brain works better.
Right.
And we're quite pleased to see these outcomes. And this was published in the biofeedback journal from AAPB, the Association for Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. It's a Medline-listed journal and has been in existence for, oh goodness, many, many years. I believe somewhere in the 35-40-year range. So the literature for the field ends up being populated with some of these outcomes now. The study on stimulant prediction was published in the Journal of Integrative Neuroscience, which is a royal publication out of England, that's also where the depression study is being published. And we're trying to publish all of our approach. We've also published some interesting data on individuals having difficulty maintaining vigilant focus due to sleep problems and the impact of poor sleep. And at this point, there's good evidence for neurofeedback assisting with sleep. Insomnia can be treated effectively using neurofeedback. And there's a very well-constructed study that came out of Salzburg, Austria, and a major research laboratory out of Europe, where they did SMR training with a clinical group. They did random frequency training in the control group. And at that point, we ended up seeing the improvement in sleep. Studied in an fMRI machine, they recorded a full polysomnography with EEG, they've observed using actigraph technology, which is objective evidence, that sleep onset was enhanced and wakefulness was reduced using the SMR training.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in the literature now. That was published in Sleep in 2008, and the laboratory is Dr. Klemisch's laboratory in Salzburg. And the researchers were Manuel Chabas and Kirsten Hodelmoser.
Mm-hmm.
So the field is now getting very good validation studies for our applications being done in academic laboratories in Europe.
Good. Well, I really appreciate what you're taking the time and explaining all of this to us and the wonderful work that you're doing and the untired effort you're putting into the research. It's an incredible bank of information that you have pulled together, and it certainly shows how you're helping people build a better brain.
Well, we do what we can, and we try and publish everything we do. So
good. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate it, Jay. I want to mention that next week we will be concluding this series, and we will be giving you detailed information on how you can find qualified neurofeedback practitioners that can help you with specific problems and how you can then build a better brain right here in the greater Chicagoland area. I also want to remind you that you can get more information, see firsthand what neurofeedback is about, and have all your questions answered, whether neurofeedback is right for you. You can come to a free information seminar that's held around the Chicago area. I'm doing one next Friday evening at 7 p.m. at the Rua Center, 1110 North Washington Street in Naperville, right off of I-88. For more information or for directions, just email me at drjim@ultimatebrain.com or go to eegchicago.com for the names and locations of other practitioners close to your home. For now, I'd like to thank members of EEG Chicago and the entire crew here at WYLL. Remember, the brain is a pattern engine. It loves to execute patterns that result in thoughts, behaviors, and feelings. Practice those patterns that express love to one another, and you will come to experience feelings of joy and peace. Thank you for listening to Building a Better Brain.
You've been listening to Building a Better Brain with show host Dr. Jim Kowal from EEGChicago.com on Chicago's Christian Talk, AM 1160. To learn more about today's topic, their Chicagoland locations, seminars in your area, or general information, visit EEGChicago.com. You can also email Dr. Jim with your questions and comments anytime at drjim@ultimatebrain.com. Join Dr. Jim Kowal again next Saturday morning at 7:30 to explore ways to restore and expand your brain's functioning safely and drug-free.